So the in simple language, Buddha nature is a complex word, but in simple language, awakening is already part of us. And that's the title of the talk. And the truth is, talking about awakening creates problems usually for the people listening, not so much for the person talking. And it actually creates many, many reactions, such as a desire for it, worshipping it in a way, regarding it as beyond or place me ever, even the language I use during meditation, island, the Buddha's language, an island in the middle of the stormy seas of samsara, and the natural reaction is, I want to be there on that island, take me there. And then it does create in us sometimes a sense that it's too far, it's too difficult, leave me alone with all this language of awakening, enlightenment, I don't want to know about it, I just want to be a little bit more kind of settled in my life and solve my problems, and I don't want to know about it. Or even more than that, a sense of failure. I'll never get there, and it's just, I can't do it, and let other people do it. The Buddha can talk about it, but not me. Little me. In some way or other, it's also scaring us, because the whole intuitively, the whole issue of awakening is somewhere or other destroying the sense of self, of me. Because it doesn't go together. Awakening and me just don't go together. And so there is an intuition that as much as we talk about a certain freedom, the self comes in there and says, yes, but I need to know who I am. I need to know about me. And that I'm like this, and my life is like that, and I expect this in my life, and I want to do this in my life, and I want to have a sense of stability in my life, and awakening seems very unstabling and deconstructing of the me. And the me can be very scared about. We are afraid that we may not be who we think we are. We are afraid that we may not be who we think we are. It can be scary. Afraid of the unknown. And so we tend to, you know, to do things with awakening, and that's why we tend to turn it into God, make it very difficult, and that's the Theravada community haven't helped over thousands of years by talking about awakening as only happening after many, 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 many lifetimes. It doesn't help. It makes it into a god. And also it doesn't help to do the opposite, to make awakening, you know, being a bit more comfortable and free in our life. To making it small. In other words, making it big, making it small. So all of these issues have a certain difficulty. But I think that the difficulty we experience when we talk about awakening, and the way we use it and push it up and make it big and make it small and make it frightening and make it this, actually show that it's inside us already. Because if it wasn't there, we wouldn't care a damn about it. It wouldn't be of interest at all. We do something with it because it's meaningful to us. There's something in us that is already somehow, it's like the rainbow. We desire the rainbow, but we cannot get there. The self can't catch the rainbow. But we all want the rainbow, and we know we can't catch it. And it always will be beyond our grasp, because it's beyond the self. So therefore the self wants it, but can never get there. And that creates all these issues around it. And in the Buddhist tradition, it's expressed very often as simply the desire for happiness, that everybody has a desire for happiness. And 99% of the human species, and probably not only humans, will say, well, happiness is getting what I want. And it starts with a baby. Happiness is when I get the titty. If I don't get the titty, I cry. So, happiness is getting what I want, but if we look more deeply at it, the wish for happiness is the wish for completion, Shleimut. The baby wishes for the titi because that moment there is completion. The baby at its perfection, Shleimut, at that moment, between the baby is getting what it needs, but what does it mean getting what it needs? The baby needs something from life. The baby is life. So the baby's, or the person, is, we are life. And we say, we need something else to be happy. But we are there already. There isn't a place we can say we are not there. We need completion. Because we have made an act of separation. When the act of separation means we need completion. So we might say, put it in the language of, my body is hungry, I need burekas. But what does that mean? Why is the body hungry? The body is relating to the world. The world is the body is the world. There is a relationship there. The body is saying, something missing here. But that's relationship. So, in a deep way, happiness, this desire for happiness is desire for completion, which in some way is already there. It's just that we suddenly experience we don't have it, so we want it. But if it was impossible to have completion, we would never want it. The completion, Shleimut, is here already, and then we miss it. It's kamo chor bifnim, it's like a hole. I'm not complete, so I need it, and therefore I need to be happy. So even the movement for happiness is, in some way, even expressed as I need $1 million, is still the urge for completion because we do know what completion is. We have it somewhere deep underneath the person is a sense of completion. Shleimut is there in us already in some deep way. And we express it certainly by suffering. When we feel the separation, we suffer. When we are hungry, we suffer. Suffering, dukkha, is also a sign that we know completion and then we miss it. And then we suffer. And then we are complete again and we don't suffer. So it's kind of the whole cycle of completion and then separation and needing and missing something and chaser and back to it shows we are dancing around completion and suffering when it's not there. It shows that there is a kind of a movement in us already of completion, separation. And the self, it turns it into a story. And then says, I need $1 million, then if I have $1 million, I'm complete. Of course, the person that wants $1 million is never complete, because he needs the next million, and the next one, and the next one. So it's never an end, and that's the suffering, it's never ending. And that's desire and attachment, it never ends. But the self does that. And this is the crucial area of no self, because if there isn't a real sense of self, then nothing really happens. The self is making this story. But imagine there's no self, there's hunger and satisfaction. Nothing is happening. You eat, you don't eat. The self turns it into stories. And makes it big issues. And in many ways, many teachers I heard, and I, at the beginning I was really puzzled by this, many teachers coming from understanding this, is Theravada teachers, said, if it wasn't for Nibbana, then we would be destroyed by suffering. Nibbana, in us already, allows us to cope with suffering. And I didn't understand it at first. I thought, what does it mean, Nibbana already in us? It means we would be destroyed if not for Nibbana. Now I understand it a little bit more. I'm not sure, I don't understand it at us off, but I understand it more for sure, that it's this sense of completion, separation, suffering as being a sign of some of separation, of isolation, of attachment, but then all of that whole picture is based on oneness. And without that oneness, which is sometimes painful and sometimes not, but the self experiences as painful and not painful, without that oneness we would be destroyed, we would be finished, there would be no completion anywhere. The Buddha nature is a Tibetan concept. It's a Mahayana concept. It's not a Theravada concept. And it's close to another Mahayana concept called the womb, garb, Tathagata garb. It's the womb rechem of awakening that is in us. And it's Buddha nature is in its developed form, and the womb is like a seed of awakening in all human beings. And it's described as the womb. And I think it's the womb because the womb is empty and gives birth. The womb is potential. And so it's the potential to express awakening, and express also pain. So the womb is exactly what I said before, but expressed as an image. The womb is in us as potential for completion. We have it in us already, but it can go in the direction of samsara or go in the direction of awakening. When it goes in the direction of awakening, it becomes clearly our Buddha nature. The womb is not yet Buddha nature. That's the kind of Mahayana vision of it, and I don't want to go into it too much. But the important thing is that it gives us enough hint, this womb, this rechem of awakening, it's enough to push us towards awakening. And there's something in human beings that is pushing them towards liberation. It can be expressed as a desire for liberation. It can be expressed as a desire for, $1 million. It's distorted. It's akum. About adayin, it's expressed, I want to be complete. I want to be happy. I want to join the rest of life. I want to be quiet and rest. I want to finish with all that struggle. I want to come home. And it's done through this very distorted way. But it's still there, seen as this seed of awakening, pushing us towards awakening. And slowly, slowly, there is an understanding in the Dharma that slowly, slowly, all beings are pushed to awakening. And that somehow that is why we're existing in this body, in this planet, in this life. That the purpose of life, if there is purpose, that's not Buddhist language, purpose, by the way. It's more psychological language. But it's that there is a movement, and it's the deepest movement that exists in us. A movement to awakening. And in the Buddhist understanding, this can take many lives. And we can live and die and live and die and live and die, but the whole thing is moving towards awakening. This living, dying, living, dying, living, dying is bringing us closer, closer, closer. The Theravada tradition, this is expressed as the paramitas. Paramitas are qualities, that every life that we lead, we add qualities higher qualities, and that after many lives, the qualities are matured, and then we become a Buddha. That's the traditional formula. I'm not that interested in the formulas. It's okay that they're there, but you can look at them as metaphor or as image. But it's a question that I really would ask you to look at in yourselves. What is it in me that's pushing me towards awakening? What is it in me that's doing that? If you look at it very carefully, I don't believe you'll find it's on the level of me as a person. That it needs Stephen as a person, a personality, to own that longing for awakening. I don't think you'll find it in the person. I think it's deeper than the person. It's the womb. It's the Tathagata garbha. Garbha in Tibetan. Or I think it's Tibetan. Maybe Sanskrit. I don't know. Garbha sounds Sanskrit. It doesn't sound Tibetan. Yeah, it's Sanskrit. But it's the womb. It's something not in the person. The person interprets it and says, oh, I want to go on a course, I want this, I need completion, I want a peaceful life, I want to go to the forest and meditate, I want to go to a monastery, I want to have wisdom, I want, you know, all kinds of things. The person will do things with it, but the urge, the movement, you may find it's under the person. It's not exactly on the level of my personality. It's an urge that's deeper. And there is something also a sort of a deep understanding here that if awakening is described or understood as what's sometimes called total suchness, kahut tatata is called in Sanskrit, isness, totally isness, ze. I don't know how to say it. Kahut, okay, ze. That's it. Nothing more exists. That's it. But defining or understanding awakening as that's it is not personal. That's it, or ze, or kahut, cannot be owned by anybody. And therefore, it must belong to everybody. And therefore, it must be in us already. Because it cannot be owned, it doesn't belong to anybody, therefore we already have it. It's already in everything. It's already in this being. The question is, we don't know where to look. We don't know where to look for it. There's a beautiful text, actually, a Mahayana text, 12 different images of the womb or the suchness inside that is covered over by a person, personality, self, conditioning. One is of a gold statue of a person that's covered by mud. Another one is the jewel at the bottom of the pool of water that you can't see it. You have to look for it. There's 12 of these images. They're very beautiful images. Can't remember more than that. And it is a little bit, that what it does occur to me is that it is a little bit like quantum physics, where everybody, when they look at anything, sees something. But quantum physics seems to get right to the edge of reality in some way. And at that edge, there isn't anything left. There is just potential. When, before something is known in quantum physics, before a particle is known, it's not a particle, it's not a wave, it's not a thing, it can't, its place can't be defined, it's out of time, it, you can never know what it is. It, all you can call it is a potential to be something. And then as soon as you look at it, it turns into whatever it is that the instrument of your looking expects to find. If your instrument is looking, is expecting to find particles, matter, you will see matter. If it is looking to find energy, you'll see it as energy. Whatever instrument you use to look at it, it will be there as whatever it is you look at. In other words, you're back to kind of this mystery, which is so much the Dharma, which is that you can never define anything, because the way you define it, it becomes what you, as you define it. Your consciousness and the world are totally interacting. There isn't a world. There isn't, world and consciousness make each other. So you're back to that. And what is the womb? Potential. Suchness. Potential of suchness. Just potential. So I mean, all that may be very confusing and so on. I think to see it as our potential for awakening, our potential for wisdom, our potential, the womb, the seed in us that gives birth, that will give birth, even if it's distorted and put in all the person, makes all kinds of stories out of it and turns it into wanting this and wanting that and wanting happiness and wanting, but somehow or other, it's already existing, a freedom that exists in us, and we need to trust it. One of the places that we can, it doesn't lend itself to a concept, but we can trust it. And trusting it is an important movement in our spiritual life. We need to trust that there is this womb of awakening in us all the time, this Buddha nature is there in us all the time. We have to trust it. We have to keep going back to it. We have to know that it is it. And the more we trust it, the more it becomes alive to us. It becomes, in a way, more important than all the stories of me and mine. In samsara, it makes samsara all a dream. The point of view of awakening turns samsara into a dream, into non-existing. And it's, from the point of view of samsara, it looks very real. I'm struggling, I have pain in my back, I don't have enough love in my life, I've got sankharas of anger, fears, I've got, you know, all the samsara looks. I'm struggling with health, I'm struggling with relationships, I'm old, I'm young, I'm this, I'm that. All samsara are very real. From the point of view of the Buddha nature in us, samsara is just a dream. It's just illusion. It doesn't have solidity. Because from the awakening point of view, from it's in English the word adventitious. It's stuck on us. In the way to, I can describe it. It's stuck, you know, that we don't know that, it means it's stuck on us. Nidbak. Nidbak aleinu. It's stuck. Some sense of samsara being, you know, So the movement of completion makes us go into suffering, and then we feel it's all very real. We forgot that it's the movement of completion, and we forgot there is something in us that knows completion. It's a forgetting. As soon as we have a point of view of awakening, we see that it's all an illusion. It's all like a dream. It has no cause, samsara. It has no reality. Where does it start? Where does it end? Who invented samsara? Where's its beginning? Where's its end? And this is classic. This is in the Buddhist text of 2,500. This is in basic Buddha Dharma from original suttas. No beginning, no end to samsara. No existence, no reality. It's a dream. And that is powerful movement for us to turn away from it. Nibbada means turning away to our awakened self. Because it's a dream, it brings us suffering, it's not worth it. In the big sense, it's not worth it. And this sounds very, very big, but actually many, you know, if we look at it, you know, sometimes you're dealing with the aging issue, and I'm dealing with the aging issue, but yeah, everyone's dealing with the aging issue actually. But you know, you see people who are older age, or people that have been through serious disease like Yael Pazuello, they experience nibbada. Not nirvana, nibbada means turning away. They experience, yeah, okay, but the whole thing is not worth it. I let go. I let go of samsara. I let go of all that struggle. I let go of taking my life, all my needs and regrets and issues and so on seriously. I let go of being self. Anyway, you have to. But you meet some beautiful old people that actually, or sick people that just managed to break through and said, Zell, I'm not there. I'm turning away from all of that. And when you turn away, there's only one place to go, and that's towards liberation. And that's why someone like Yael, who did this turning away, can stand up and say, you know, I may die soon, but for me, life is, this moment is totally joyful. And it's because of the turning away. There's no other place you can turn away to. When you turn away from samsara, there isn't any other place to go except towards our inner, inbuilt awakening nature. There's no other place to go. We need to keep practicing. We need to be serious. Because if we keep touching it and forgetting and so on, we can be years more or less going around the awakening in us, but not really taking it too seriously. So it does need to be serious. It doesn't need a special kind of practice. We don't need to kind of say, oh, just if we do Vipassana, we'll get it. It doesn't so much need that, but it needs that movement of slowly, slowly, slowly realizing, okay, Vipassana is good enough. My thoughts that I take it so seriously are not real. They're not so serious. I don't need to believe them. I don't need to take them as true. So what is instead of them? Something much freer. Awareness. Which the ocean and the waves. So when I stop being busy with waves, there's only the ocean. There isn't any other place to be. So it all leads us towards awakening. As soon as we kind of, but we have to keep going and keep on that track. And when we do that, things slow down, cool down. As the Buddha said, samsara is burning. We might think, well, that's my life. How can you say it's burning? But from the point of view of awakening, it is burning. From the awakening, from the point of view of awakening, samsara is a hell of a bo'er, you know, sorev. It's like activity to find completion, to find happiness, to push things, to make conflict, to protect ourselves, to get what we want, to, it's like, whoa, every second we need this, we don't need, we like, we don't. It's so much burning. From the awakened point of view, it's crazy. And we need to kind of cool down. And that's why the word Nibbana is the same word as cooling. It comes from the same root, cooling. Cooling down, cooling the fire. And this contact with the awakened potential in us brings us quietness, it brings us cooling down, it brings us close to some inner nature that we have, our inner center, because it's already there. It sort of connects us to a place in us that's already there. And we rest in it. And we find that instead of crazily trying to find happiness in conditions and in situations and to complete ourselves and to, I brought one or two quotations of Krishnamurti as a, because I do like the way he's got such beautiful language, who describes this cooling down, this vision of Nibbana. In the silence of deep night, and in the quiet still morning, when the sun is touching the hills, there is a great mystery. It is there in all living things. If you sit quietly under a tree, you would feel the ancient earth with its incomprehensible mystery. Mystery, iyavana, you can't understand it. On a still night, when the stars are clear and close, you would be aware of expanding space and the mysterious order of all things, of the immeasurable and of nothing. In that utter silence of the mind, this mystery expands without time and space. Ordinary experience is the death of this mystery. To be in communion with it, the mind, the whole of you, must be at the same level, at the same time, with the same intensity as that which is called mysterious. And this is love. With this, the whole mystery of the universe is open. Another quote from Krishnamurti. That morning, the sea was like a lake or an enormous river without a ripple, and so calm that you could see the reflections of the stars so early in the morning. The dawn had not yet come, and so the stars and the reflection of the cliff and the distant lights of the town were there on the water. As I watched, a great stillness came into me. The brain itself became very quiet, without any reaction, without a movement. And it was strange to feel this immense stillness. Feel isn't the word. The quality of that silence, that stillness, is not felt by the brain. It is beyond the brain. The brain can conceive or design or formulate the future, but this stillness is beyond its range, beyond all imagination, beyond all desire. I am so still that my body becomes completely part of the earth, part of everything that is still. I was everything. I was the light and the beauty of love. Again, to say I was a part of everything is also wrong. The word I is not adequate, because I really wasn't there. I didn't exist. There was only that stillness, the beauty, the extraordinary sense of love. So, it's very clear that we can't own this. This is not something that you and me can own it. This is not in our possession. This is beyond the range of our mind, of our brain, beyond the range of our self. When we practice, it's really important to understand that we're not practicing to experience anything. We are practicing to become this. Our consciousness becomes it. We turn into it. Our consciousness is it. So there's nothing to understand. It's not that we understand awakening. Awakening takes us. We can't own it. And I went to have these long talks with Ajahn Amaro in the abbot of Amaravati, and he's probably the most senior Theravada monk now in the Western world after Ajahn Sumedho retired and went off to live in a village in Thailand. And Ajahn Amaro is really the head of the Theravada community monks in the Western world. And he said a beautiful thing to me as I was leaving. He said, don't forget that the whole thing, means the whole spiritual journey of the Buddha, is the Dharma knowing its own nature. Yeah. the whole thing is the Dharma knowing its own nature. Meaning, it's not ours. It's the Dharma, namely the awakened being in us, joining the universe, rejoining the place where we became separate. The Dharma knowing its own nature. It's just things returning to themselves. No one there. And that's suchness. That's isness. And we lose ourselves in that isness. Isness is happening. It's not me, it's not mine. So I think in our own journey to make it a little more down to earth for us, we can see that our journey may well be a movement from an ordinary experience of ordinary life with an awakened center somewhere that we're not aware of to some important individual realizations or understandings. For me, I could say it was in the 60s, probably, my individual understanding. I got sort of hit on the head by the 60s phenomena and suddenly realized that what I thought of before then as reality wasn't real. That's what happened to me in the 60s. So individual experience, we go to a retreat and we question what previously we thought of as real, my thoughts about something, for example. And that leads us to deal with suffering. That leads us to a sense of coping with samsara wisely, to develop wisdom. And developing wisdom eventually leads us to this place of the Dharma, knowing the Dharma. It leads us to an awakened place. It's like awakening is happening by itself, through us, and wisdom is a part of it. Wisdom is a shift at the level of the self meeting awakening, but still, it's still self there. So wisdom arises, we develop, we practice, we have more wisdom all the time. It's something that we can develop. And eventually, we have to let it all go, and that's when awakening is happening by itself, in a way. We can't design it, we can't control it. And a lot of the teaching that we are using in the Buddhist world, like Paticca-samuppada, conditioning, is on the level of wisdom. And it is needed. In fact, almost all the teaching is on the level of wisdom. We need it to, in a way, undo the illusion of samsara, to undo the illusion of reality. But it isn't awakening itself. It's the wisdom as awakening is unfolding. The ultimate place is not in any method or any teaching, or it's not in Paticca-samuppada. It's beyond qualities. It's beyond paramis. It's exactly the story. The parami, you know, you build paramis over a life. You build qualities of peace, of joy, of love, of wisdom, of energy, of calm, or build all these paramis, and then in the end, the ultimate, the awakening is happening in another place. This is invitation to awakening. The awakening happens by itself. And then we come back to the marketplace. It is true that there is a intimacy between form and formless. We can't, awakening doesn't take us somewhere else completely and put us on top of a high tower, like some outer place. There's a dance happening between form and the formless, between samsara and nibbana. The suchness, the tatata, suchness, isness, the zeze, of quality of awakened moment, like Krishnamurti was describing, is also in relation to forms. Forms, you can't cancel them. They're not that awakening suddenly all samsara, all forms are gone. It's much more, the Buddha was very clear. Forms arise, but we don't take them as absolute truth. They're not there as themselves, but they're not there. And so I want to finish with one of my favorite quotes of all from the Buddhist suttas on awakening. And someone asked the Buddha, what happens to somebody that's awakened? And the Buddha said, it's like a flame that's struck by a sudden gust of wind. In a flash, it's gone out, and nothing more can be known about it. It's the same with a wise man freed from mental existence in the mind or person. In a flash, he's gone out, and nothing more can be known about him. And Upasiva, the person asking the Buddha, please explain this clearly to me. You are a wise man. You know precisely the way these things work. Has the man disappeared? Does he simply not exist? Or is he in some perpetual state of well-being, of completion, of well-being, of perfection? And the Buddha answered, when a person has gone out, then there is nothing by which you can measure him or her. That by which he can be talked about is no longer there for him. You cannot say that he does not exist. When all ways of being and all phenomena are removed, then all ways of description have also been removed. So there's nothing can be said. So with that, we'll just take a couple of minutes of silence.